Welcome back to Building Tomorrow, a show dedicated to the ways tech and innovation are making the world a freer and more prosperous place. I'm your host, Paul Matsko. I'm joined by Will Duffield and special guest Zach Graves from the Lincoln Network. Thanks for coming on the show, Zach.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Ryan Radia, the Senior Policy Counsel at the Lincoln Network. Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Happy to be here.
So today I thought we'd talk about something that's very much in the news. It's very much of the moment. I think starting early 2018 is when it first kind of showed up on my radar. Complaints about anti-conservative bias online on social media. And so I'd like to dig into hype versus reality, dig into the different forms that that takes, and just have a conversation about this concept, because whether or not it's something that tech policy folks spend all that much time talking about, and I'm not sure we actually do spend as much time on the issue as we do on other subjects, it's something that's very much in the minds of ordinary conservatives around the country. The idea that the big tech companies are conspiring to shut out conservative voices. So why don't we start with forms? Like, how is this showing up, or at least how are the allegations of this context showing up? Yeah, Zach.
So, I mean, I think it's important that it's not just sort of your average conservative activists, but it's also, you know, a big topic in a lot of recent congressional hearings with Republican policymakers in both the House and Senate who are pretty riled up about this idea that, you know, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or even Google search or Google News being sort of, you know, structurally biased against conservatives. I think this draws a lot out of the same tropes in the sort of conventional media bias narrative that has been in some way, shape, or form in the conservative movement for a long time, and that it's been sort of applied to the tech industry in particular, because I think the big tech companies are seen to be sort of bastions of, you know, progressive liberal thought. If you look at, you know, San Francisco, you know, about 10% voted for Donald Trump in 2016. So it is like hard to argue it's not a very liberal place. And so I think the jump that people are making is they're saying these big, powerful platforms, you know, have, you know, complete control over a lot of the stuff we do to express ourselves on the internet now, or how, you know, information is filtered down to us that we use on a day-to-day basis. And since they're a bunch of liberals, therefore, you know, maybe they're trying to conspire against us. And I think that's the theory they have here. And this has come out in a number of different specific expressions.
That suspicion, that cultural belief about those who make the rules or write the code, is paired with a certain lack of transparency on the firm's part, but also a certain level of ignorance amongst users and policymakers. And I think that's often the nexus of this. You get a result you don't like. You perhaps don't receive the views you expect that your op-ed or YouTube video ought to. And because you aren't quite sure how all of this works, and it does seem pretty opaque, then there's a lot of room within that uncertainty for perhaps conspiratorial thinking about what's going on.
The technical term for this from the medical field is the nocebo effect. So folks have heard about the placebo effect, like where you ascribe positive benefits to something that didn't actually cause. There's no causal relationship. So, you know, sugar pill solved my cancer, or magnets or copper bracelets or whatever, right? The nocebo effect is the flip, to ascribe negative outcomes to something that didn't actually cause those negative outcomes. So the idea that, well, look, the Twitter auto-populate field, when people start putting in my name, it doesn't auto-populate with my name, but it auto-populates with someone who I don't like on the other side of the political spectrum. Ergo, this must be a negative outcome directed at me rather than...
One side is hyper-conscious of this, I think, in a large part because their internet pundits matter more to them as a movement. Conservatives are more concerned and more ready to recognize bias where it may or may not exist. Thinking of that auto-populate issue last summer with Twitter, that was something that did not merely affect conservatives. All of the Chapo boys didn't show up in the drop-down list either. But Nancy Pelosi isn't looking out for those guys.
Right.
She'd rather they went away. Ted Cruz is pretty concerned about Diamond and Silk or whoever else you think of within that right-wing YouTube ecosystem.
So I think like the conservative movement in general is very sensitive about this topic. They've seen, you know, conservative speech, you know, the sort of what the boundaries of what is sort of acceptable speech has been shifting. They've had to sort of be on the defensive and in sort of campus speech contexts for, you know, a while. They, you know, they've been losing on a lot of the sort of culture war issues. And they're worried, I think, about these becoming no longer acceptable in the sort of digital town square to talk about. I think it's also particularly concerning for, you know, Republican members in the House, since they rely a lot, you know, they have to run for re-election every 2 years. They have to, you know, rely on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, all of these platforms to get their message out, to run ads, to go defeat their opponent. And if they think, you know, the guys back in Menlo Park are trying to rig it against them, I mean, that's a real thing to worry about. Whether that's a justified fear is another conversation.
And it's worth noting that activists of all stripes often have frustrations that their speech is being targeted by these platforms. It's not just conservatives. However, the activists who aren't conservative are less likely to attribute decisions to block their content to an underlying political motivation. So as an example of this, the Black Lives Matter movement often finds some of its activists having their posts taken down. There's a recent example of a black woman who posted "White men are so fragile" as a comment on a story about Liam Neeson's experience trying to find someone who was black to assault. The distinction is that when those who are conservative are the subject of having their speech taken down, they are likely to attribute it to some underlying conspiracy, as Zach mentioned. Now, with respect to the nocebo effect, in many of these situations, when speech is taken down for a reason that is unrelated to the political views, the conservatives tend to believe that it's their politics. And even those who aren't conservative might think that. An example is the anti-abortion movement often uses fairly graphic imagery to try to persuade people not to get abortions. So there have been various campaigns that have been the subject of takedowns. And the assumption is that that's because these platforms are vehemently pro-abortion, where they just might not want graphic content. Now, this isn't unique to the right. An example is when Elizabeth Warren recently paid for a campaign ad calling for the breakup of big tech. Facebook for a time removed it based on the perfectly plausible explanation that they gave later on, that it was the use of Facebook's trademark logo in the ad that they don't approve of. And it may well be and likely is that Facebook would take down that ad in any context. It's just in this context,
good,
it looks
good reason
bad
for Facebook to do so if you're concerned about graft and manipulation on the platform. If someone bills their new multi-level marketing scheme as endorsed by Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg in an ad on the platform, this isn't something that Facebook wants to go on. And takes us back in some ways to the legitimacy or the question of whether Facebook is a legitimate moderator of its own platform. And increasingly on the right, I see a rejection of that, a belief that, well, this is Facebook's property. They nonetheless owe some broader duty to moderate it in one fashion or another.
It's been suggested to both your points that there are groups that, in a sense, have weaponized this distrust and are using people's kind of lack of understanding of how the platforms work to manipulate the system to generate false positives for discrimination. So like with the Warren example, it's been mooted. This is alleged that her campaign staff might have known, and whether they did or not, you can imagine a politician saying, I'm going to violate the terms of service knowingly, and so I can turn a $100 campaign ad purchase into the equivalent of thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of media attention when it gets taken down. And I'll say it's for the reason, not the actual reason. I'll say it's because they're against my campaign. They don't like my politics. So whether or not Warren, I'm not going to say Warren's campaign knew that, though it's been mooted online.
But that's a rational strategy.
It's a rational
whether
strategy.
Or not she did that, a story that she's running ads to break up Facebook on Facebook is a good story. The story that Facebook is trying to stop her, proving her point, is an even better story.
Well, and she afterward fires off a tweet. You know, it's terrifying that these firms have the ability to determine the bounds of debate in this country.
Yeah.
And yet her complaint and the fact that it was so well covered and discussed on legacy media in print and on indicated that her premise that these firms are capable of controlling the bounds of debate was rubbish.
So it's possible for there to be lots of not good faith conversation. So, and you can even imagine this too. Imagine a pro-life group purposefully using the most visceral imagery it can, knowing that it'll get blocked on the grounds of using the imagery and not, but then complain. I mean, again, it's this happened possibly with the Unplanned movie, which is big in the kind of new Christian right circles.
That was a separate issue.
It's a separate issue.
The account holder there had previously in a linked account been banned such that the Unplanned account, when it started getting a lot of traffic,
right,
was understood as a successful ban evasion attempt rather than anything with regard to the actual content.
But where does the conversation go, though? It doesn't go towards, well, this is a relatively narrow technical violation of the rules of service. It's, no, this is because the big media, big social media doesn't want this anti-abortion story to get out there. Right.
And it seemed like they had some kind of a bot configured to sort of unfollow people who tried to follow them, which also would have violated the terms of service and seems to have no other purpose other than ginning up press.
And again, whether or not these particular situations that's true of, we should expect to see that style of strategy in the future.
I mean, I would be careful about writing off all of the people who think there's a grievance here as people who are, you know, trying to, you know, get free earned media. I think the bulk of, I mean, I do think it is a sort of a mainstream conservative view now that this is happening and that bias is real and it's something we should be concerned about.
It goes back to a fundamental misapprehension as to how these platforms may legally govern themselves. And it's something that you see both in not right wing, but mainstream left of center media depictions of how CDA 230, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, the kind of bedrock intermediary liability protection or provision.
How about we go to where you're taking this, Will? And Zach, flesh out what you're saying, and then why don't you take us in that the Section 230 kind of direction?
Yeah, so this gets into sort of what the, you know, desired policy responses are. But I mean, first I think it's important to distinguish, you know, criticizing them from a, like, this should be illegal perspective versus, like, you know, what the normative stance of a Facebook is, right? Like, criticizing Facebook and saying your norms for speech ought to be different is a perfectly reasonable thing to do for conservatives. And maybe you think they're, you know, too risk averse about, you know, the kind of abortion-related imagery you can put on there or about, you know, what you can say about, you know, how you can describe immigrants. And you can go look up, I mean, Facebook is somewhat transparent about their policies these days. You can go look up, you know, a lot of their guidance on the internet and about what they can do, what you can do and what you can't do. And other platforms, I think, are a little bit more ad hoc. And I think there's probably a fair criticism that, you know, some of the high profile people they banned or suspended were for likely political reasons from pressure from different groups.
Or certainly at least just not explained very well with reference to their own policies.
Right.
And Facebook has always been concerned about becoming an arbiter of truth, but in not wanting to open that can of worms, it seems sometimes they fall back upon other explanations for bans that are essentially driven by someone's continual spreading of misinformation.
Like Facebook hasn't done themselves any favors in how they've handled a lot of things lately. And, you know, people tend to be very critical of Twitter, but Twitter's actually like pretty permissive about the kinds of people they let on their platform. And it seems like most of the complaints about people who are like permanently banned were doing bad things, whether that's being, you know, inciting harassment or racial slurs or other things. There's this article, there's a study from the website Quillette that they purported to do a rigorous study of people, everyone ever banned on Twitter who was high profile and sort of had to generate a news story, and there are a couple other criteria. You know, and they said these are the ones who were high profile who voted for Donald Trump, and here's the ones who weren't. And, you know, it was like 95%, you know, of people who voted for Trump, you know, were the ones out of the banned list. But they published this data set on the internet, and I emailed them about it. And if you look at it, it's like not who you'd consider like rank and file or mainstream Republicans.
It included the American Nazi part.
Right, that's the punchline here. It had literally... Yeah. A who's who of neo-Nazis and alt-right and conspiracy peddlers. And maybe there's a sort of very libertarian norm about speech where you say, well, we don't agree, these people are bad, but, you know, platforms ought to allow them. And, you know, you can think that if you want. But my perspective is that Twitter has an interest in providing, like, a quality experience on its platform. And having a bunch of neo-Nazis, you know, going on about, you know,
not a quality
experience.
The stuff
they go on about is not a quality experience. You need to have some kind of moderation purely for, like, an editorial function. Like, imagine, like, Reddit if there was no upvoting and downvoting, or just, like, go to a YouTube comment section. Like, these are not quality experiences. And you know, places like Twitter and Facebook try to curate a more quality experience for you by their nature. And that involves, you know, value judgments about what quality is, yeah. Right?
But if at the baseline you believe that some publisher platform distinction matters in creating the legal immunity that these companies have with respect to user content, if you believe that any editorial function renders them liable for user content or pushes them towards some First Amendment standard, then any moderation will seem illegitimate to you. And I think it's that misapprehension which drives a lot of these complaints.
And that's, I mean, and you use misapprehension. I mean, you're playing devil's advocate there, right?
I'm not. No, I think perhaps among like Ted Cruz and the like, it's willful. But if you look at what rank and file conservatives get, both from Fox News and Vox, unfortunately,
the Washington Post.
They'll
too,
have this,
where it was Megan McArdle who was repeating an erroneous interpretation of the law and what the law means. And this has been pretty popular in some like right wing circles to repeat these talking points. I'm not sure where exactly they came from, but you know, I think it's a lot of the
someone's gonna read a dissertation on that.
Yeah, people like Ted Cruz and some others. And this gets into the sort of idea of, okay, we think there's this problem of the conspiracy against conservatives on these big platforms, and they're big and evil and have these gateways. And this is where you see Tucker Carlson converging with Elizabeth Warren in a very scary way. And therefore, government needs to step in and do something about it. And one of the remedies purportedly is weakening or altogether gutting CDA 230, I believe the.
So let me explain that for our audience.
Congressman Gohmert wanted to do mostly away with it.
He wanted everything to be presented in precise chronological order, which would make your Google searches really fun.
Well, Twitter used to be in chronological order, and they changed that. And most people have kept the current organization of tweets, where they're organized by the level of interest, as opposed to when they came first. One proposal that hasn't been fully fleshed out, but that is a good example of how some conservatives would change Section 230, is Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri has suggested that for intermediaries to be protected from the content of their users, even when they engage in some moderation, they would have to be neutral platforms. That is, they would have to treat content in a way that doesn't favor one ideology over another.
Yeah, that's of course the nut there. Well, it's problematic too because why don't we go back for a second? So Section 230 for our listeners, we say 230 in this room and everyone's like, oh, we immediately know what that means. Communications Decency Act in the 90s, this is a particular clause of that act. And what it says is that online platforms can't be indemnified. They can't be sued for content that they can't be held liable, criminally liable or civilly liable for content that their users post to the platform. And that is regardless of whether there is no distinction in there whether they're a platform or a publisher. So this whole conversation about, well, once they start editorializing, once they start choosing some content to promote, some content not, they're no longer a neutral platform. They're now a publisher. Therefore, they're not covered under 230. That's not real. That's not in the text of Section 230.
Back in the 90s, you had a series of cases, one in which an internet service provider, AOL, I believe, lightly moderated or didn't really moderate the contents of a forum at all. And as such, when someone sued them, they weren't found to be liable. So in the wake of Stratton Oakmont v. Prodigy, other services felt that to engage in any moderation, to try to improve the user experience, to filter out pornography, whatever it was, would render them liable. And it was something that for reasons of risk avoidance, they couldn't do. So in order to both allow these firms to grow, to provide these services at scale when they couldn't preview every user comment, and also to allow them to do their best to try out new strategies in keeping their platform free of whatever it was their users didn't like, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is part of a broader omnibus telecoms bill, both on one hand prevented these firms from being liable for user-generated content so long as they didn't help to create
except
it.
Except at the federal level, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And for copyright. But as long as they didn't create it, they weren't liable for it. And two, that they couldn't be sued for their moderation actions, even if it took down what would have been considered constitutionally protected speech if the government were the one doing it.
Right. I mean, the irony is it was expressly designed in part. One of its purposes was to expressly allow platforms to moderate. So the thing people are complaining about is the polar opposite of what section, one of the driving impulses of Section 230.
And this was back in the 90s when both the left and right were organized together around preventing children from listening to rap music
and playing violent video games.
So this
right.
is...
And the rest of all of the other sections of the CDA were things you probably wouldn't
like very much,
right? It was all
big chunks of that struck down in court, I think.
Yeah, it was all unconstitutional.
Except for this bit.
Except for this bit, which was designed separately as a compromise that Wyden and some others sort of negotiated in smartly.
Which is, I think, telling, you mentioned Josh Hawley, Ryan, but Ron Wyden has also said that he's kind of open to further carve-outs in Section 230. Because I think his support for it was always predicated on the rest of the package back then. So,
well, I mean, his he didn't support the rest of the package.
He was only 230?
This was a negotiation tactic to get good stuff into a bad bill that was going to happen anyway.
Okay, interesting.
Wyden was not at all supportive of the other stuff.
Well, he's since come out recently and said he's in favor of carve-outs.
He's a strong, I think he's a very, I mean, he's one of the greatest sort of internet policy senators, I think. And I think he's a realist about this and that he sees there's like all kind of encroachments. We've already set the precedent that we can come in and sort of tinker with this with FOSTA SESTA, and it's going to happen again. And so, I mean, I think just as he was a realist about the original CDA, he's a realist about that this is going to get tinkered with. And, you know, if you're going to do it in a smart way. And like, you know, any statute should be sort of open to sort of revision and, you know, looking about what its effect was. The challenge here is the people that want to go in and gut CDA don't really understand what that would do. It would probably do the opposite of what they want it to do. And they want to do it for kind of bad reasons, or they're being co-opted by people who want to stick it to the companies just for that reason alone.
Or they just don't realize what the benefits of this bill are. For all of the attention paid last week to Paul Joseph Watson, Milo, Alex Jones, and a couple others being booted from Facebook in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled in a case called Daniel v. Armslist that Armslist's provision of essentially an online classified service for people buying and selling firearms was also protected under CDA 230. And this suit sought to hold them liable for the actions of one user who bought a firearm, was prohibited from doing so, purchased it in a private sale, which was legal to have private sales. Felons can't buy guns. And if this suit had succeeded, something like Armslist wouldn't be able to exist if it was seen as outside the bounds of CDA 230's protections. So in this case, kind of unnoticed, unappreciated by national media, national conservative media, CDA 230 helped to protect the ability to buy and sell firearms online.
Well, and to your point, I mean, the shape of the modern internet would be fundamentally different, and I don't think for the better, if not for CDA 230. It really stood a chance that there was a wave of lawsuits. I mean, we mentioned a few of them, but there were dozens, if not hundreds, of lawsuits working their way through the system at the time that could have strangled internet innovation in the mid 90s, but for 230. So if you as you remove those protections, you could, I mean, it runs the risk of really damaging the kind of the future shape of the internet today. Like the stuff we're taking for granted that this exists, and we're chipping away at 230 protections.
Well, I mean, this is something we talked about a little bit earlier with federal privacy legislation. I mean, before you came along, Ryan, I mean, I think like in general, at least my view is that you don't want all of these sort of internet policy issues to be handled sort of by states and municipalities. You don't want cities to be able to say, you can't have your Pokemon Go like site here or else we're going to fine you. You don't want activist AGs to come in and just try and target the, you know, Google for political reasons to try and advance their career. And you want to make it easy for sort of internet platforms to come along and have a like reasonable set of standards to comply with rather than 50 different ones that may or may not be in you know, compliant, you know, even like consistent.
It's just not workable to expect a platform that, say, facilitates home rentals or arms sales to comply with the local and laws of every jurisdiction. But one thing that 230 does is encourages these platforms to engage in some level of moderation, of controlling activity that's clearly, say, illegal or otherwise problematic without requiring them to do everything. Were it not for this protection, sites might not do anything to protect users from classified ads or transactions that are problematic. So in the context of arms sales, for example, it's possible that websites might block selling firearms that are illegal everywhere or in most places, but that doesn't mean that they're liable every single time a sale occurs that's prohibited. In the context of home sales, there might be certain baseline standards that platform sets in terms of whether you have to have, say, a carbon monoxide detector or smoke detector that doesn't open up the platform to be required to comply with the full spectrum of local laws and rules governing home rentals. When we'd prefer that the platforms do some of this when they want to, versus giving them the dichotomy of fully comply with all of the protections or do nothing, because many of them will just do nothing if that's the option they have.
In thinking about CDA's 230's protection of the ability of new firms to come into the space and innovate, and conservatives, perhaps legitimate, perhaps not, concern that at least given the cultural inputs, the current set of large social media platforms are predisposed to hold certain biases against them or merely not recognize their cultural signifiers, the language they use, and respond appropriately. Why haven't we seen more conservative interest in building alternatives to Facebook, Twitter, etc.? I know we've got Gab as a kind of Twitter clone for the dispossessed. There's Full 30 as a firearms video platform, but more broadly, and especially the deeper down the infrastructure stack we go, the less particularly institutional conservative support there seems to be for creating alternatives. Why is that, or is there more going on in this space?
I mean, partly I feel like this isn't really that big of a deal except on some like particular edge cases. Like, you know, people like Richard Spencer may be suspended from Twitter or the American Nazi Party.
He's still there. He's on Twitter.
Yeah, they put him back, but there's some of them that were banned permanently. But by and large, like, you know, I hang out in right-wing political circles and follow a lot of conservatives on Twitter, and in general, this is not an issue, right? If they were banning, you know, right-wing think tank people left and right, I would maybe think about, well, I wouldn't go to Gab, but I would go somewhere that I would be looking at, you know, alternative institutions. But I don't think the need is really that great. I also think it's hard to make an alternative Facebook. Like, network effects are hard things to overcome. I think the like business proposition of making conservative Facebook is not a very good one.
Well, right? It doesn't need to be conservative Facebook, but merely uncapturable Facebook.
Okay.
Facebook that doesn't respond to NGOs or
like absolute free speech Facebook.
Potentially.
Isn't that 8chan?
Yeah, that's right. We already have that in this.
Well, and the absence of a platform like you described that doesn't engage in blocking speech that's protected by the First Amendment, which is to say the vast majority of speech, unless it's inciting imminent lawlessness or in some limited cases is false or copyright infringing, the absence of such a platform is a testament to the fact that most users don't really want that. Some certainly do, but they're not willing to give up the fact that they want to be around the majority of other users by being affiliated with a platform like Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or Instagram that engages in some degree of moderation. So it's the desire to have some moderation going beyond the First Amendment, and the fact that, with the exception of those edge cases, as Zach mentioned, most platforms most of the time allow ideologically controversial speech to flow freely. If users didn't want moderation and they wanted more ideologically extreme speech, we might see a platform emerge and thrive. But so far, that hasn't happened, and I don't think it will.
If I can make another point here, just drawing on my own expertise for a moment. So I've written about the history of the fairness doctrine of attempting to guarantee equitable treatment of a swath of political views on the radio in the 1960s and 70s. And there's some cautionary tales from that attempt. And it's not completely dissimilar from what Holly is intimating when he talks about fighting viewpoint discrimination. So there's a sense in which it's kind of a fairness doctrine for the internet age. You can imagine a future which that's true, in which these platforms are told that if you're not allowed to say air only conservative content or host only conservative users, you have to have folks from across the political spectrum, right? And the problem with this is that even during that conversation over the fairness doctrine in radio, there was this confusion over whether someone has a right to speak or a right to be heard. And there were folks who said, we're putting the fairness doctrine because they said, look, radio station license holders, they have to operate in the public interest. It's not their property. So there's no right to property over a license. It's a matter of right to speech, but not just right to speech, because the problem is some folks can speak more freely than others. Their views are more congenial to the general population. They're more mainstream. We need to look out for the right to be heard. People who aren't being heard right now, they might speak all day long, but they're not getting on the radio. So this shift from a right to speak to a right to be heard meant limiting the rights of radio stations to air the content they want to air. Instead, it was, let's assess the community, see who currently feels unheard, and then force radio station license holders to air people from all the communities, right, regardless of how niche they are. And that ended up being used as a tool to suppress essentially conservative media in the end.
And now we seem to have stepped beyond that, because the audience isn't captive anymore. Then you had a set number of radio stations. People were driving around. That's what they had to listen to. So if you could get on the radio, you had an audience. Now everyone effectively has a right to be heard. It's a question of where. You can videotape yourself and upload it to IPFS, and it's there. People seem to be demanding a right to an audience now.
Right. That's the right to be heard.
I want this many views. Yeah. But again, it's beyond a right to be heard in the old radio sense.
What's what they meant? They want to guarantee everyone an audience is essentially what they meant by that. But you're right. I mean,
it takes me a lot of time to listen to everybody. That sounds like a terrible burden for me as an audience.
Well, and the other cautionary tale is that it's also easy to hijack that process. So it was easy to say, hey, look, I just want to guarantee fairness on the airwaves. Who can be against fairness? But the only people I'm going to go after, I'm only going to criticize stations that air conservative speech, not, you know, liberal speech. So it was used to shut down conservative broadcasting in the 60s. You can imagine a world in which imagine giving that kind of power over internet regulation to, I don't know, the Trump administration or some future administration. Do you really think that there wouldn't be a temptation to tinker like there was with the radio right in the 1960s?
I mean, there's another approach that I've heard from people in the administration who, going to your earlier point, have talked about the policy for Facebook that we should mandate is the First Amendment, and they should, anything that is within the First Amendment, they have to run it, and that's certainly and you also see sort of the other side of this where Zuckerberg is talking about, well, we want to enshrine all of our moderation practices in law.
So, and you can see why that'd be convenient for Facebook, because they can say, hey, look, don't blame us. This is enshrined in law. These are not decisions we're making. Yeah.
The way the ATR is currently valuable to them in that they know if
right.
if a group shows up on it, they don't get a Facebook account. And that's that. No questions.
I mean, I'm going to kick this to Ryan as the, you know, a legal expert, but what would Facebook, where the moderation standard is just the First Amendment, what would that look like?
So that would look pretty extreme. A lot of people, internet users who might think that that's a good idea in the abstract may not be fully familiar with the scope of what's protected. I mean, there are limits, things, content that's defamatory, as I mentioned, that incites imminent lawless action. There's even obscenity, which is content that appeals to a prurient interest. It's been described by Kathleen Sullivan as content that grosses you out but also turns you on. But the fact is that only a small portion of content that most users would consider pretty extreme is actually even debatable on the obscenity clause. Depictions of graphic violence, sexuality, extremely offensive, racist speech, all of that is fully protected by the First Amendment in most contexts. Lying is protected in many contexts. Animal crushing videos depict speech about soldiers and wartime activities being maligned, protesting gay weddings, funerals of soldiers who died on the battlefield. All of this is protected. And a platform that allowed all of the speech, those do exist on the internet, and they're not places that a lot of people want to spend time on. Right. It's understandable that no platform wants to go there, at least no major platform.
So the underappreciated in my mind are – I haven't seen much engagement between advocates of this First Amendment standard, algorithmic filtering and surfacing. You know, when you're friends with 1,000 people on Facebook and you open that news feed, it doesn't just show you a chronological ordering of the things they have posted, but I'm not sure under a First Amendment standard how even something like the Reddit upvote downvote system, or the fact that more of your friends engaged with a post about a party coming up and therefore it would show up at the front of your feed instead of some political post that nobody really liked, and how the application of a First Amendment standard would weigh in on those sorts of questions. Because when we get into deboosting or any of these other questions of algorithmic or surfacing bias, it doesn't seem as though it would have much to say there.
So it's interesting to see how the right is like shifted on this, you know, away from all that nonsense free market stuff and towards, you know, the government needs to fix this. But they've also started like adopting a lot of the kind of language and concerns of the sort of far left progressives who've been talking about algorithmic neutrality and algorithmic bias in a slightly different context for quite a while and have a pretty robust literature on it. A good recent example was something, you know, that was elevated in a Trump tweet, which was this another, you know, air quotes, study of, you know, Google News results. And they assigned, I think they searched for Trump, and then they assigned the outlets in the first 100 to right wing or left wing. And of course, all the big ones are left wing.
This was the PJ Media
the
piece?
PJ Media one. And, you know, this elevated from there to Fox and then Fox to Trump. And then they were talking about doing an executive order on it. And anyway, but the basically what it showed is that they're complaining that why isn't Breitbart News or some of these other, you know, the Daily Caller, why isn't that showing up right next to the New York Times and the Washington Post? And well, the answer is that that's not how search engines work, right? They work by, you know, they try to gauge popularity and relevance through a number of different
factors. Yeah.
You know, one of the big ones sort of approximates traffic and backlinks, and it shouldn't be a big surprise to anyone who has a sort of minimum technical understanding of this that the big popular sites are the ones on top, right? And, you know, so, their outliers were like the Wall Street Journal and Fox News. And, well, that's because those are big, right? And you can maybe criticize Google for, you know, making an editorial decision to prioritize big established firms, you know,
but
doing
news.
That's
the editorial decision that our society basically makes already with respect to the status we accord to these different institutions.
So I think if you look at a lot of these sort of bias in algorithms versions of the anti-conservative bias stories, A lot of it's just like not understanding the technical underpinnings of the technology that you're worried about, right?
Or simply resenting it. You would like Google to correct this sociocultural bias for you.
Here's where you want your fairness doctrine to come in and say that, well, we need to put extra weight to all of the Breitbart links that come in, and that way we have fair and balanced reporting.
It's the question of fair and balanced is the right phrase. Balance is different than fair, actually. So balance just means we're gonna take a set of issues, and we're going to guarantee that there's as many Republicans as Democratic viewpoints represented. Balance is 50-50, but it turns out there's lots of issues that Americans are not split 50-50 on, right? So does that mean on an issue where 90% of Americans agree, you need to give them only 50% of the, right? Like,
and there are some issues where there are more than two viewpoints.
Right.
We used to think that there was only one viewpoint on Nazis good. Well, there actually are more. There's more than one viewpoint on that issue. Or things like free trade, where it used to be that many on both sides of the political aisle were broadly supportive. That's not the case right now, of course. So the question is, do you give a say airtime or web space to views based on how popular they are? Is it just a popularity contest, or is it based on a baseline threshold of whether a view is considered meritorious and who decides that question? There's no good way of making these ideological judgments that isn't profoundly messy. And then even when you do try to go down that path, there becomes the question of whether sort of facially neutral policies are having disparate impacts based on different viewpoints. If Twitter has a policy, as they do, to ban targeted harassment campaigns, well, that may affect a user like Milo, who was banned from Twitter, more so than it affects a particular prominent speaker on the left. That doesn't mean that Twitter's anti-harassment policy is anti-conservative bias. It just means that some legitimate policies happen to correlate with conservative or liberal views.
But what do you do about policies that or how should conservatives approach policies that do seem on their face political in a sense? If you look to Twitter and its dead naming policy, on Twitter, you can't refer to a trans person by something other than their preferred pronoun. Given that, at least I understand conservatism in the United States to, in many cases, reject the necessity of using those pronouns or of respecting that choices to gender. How should conservatives understand a policy that prohibits the way linguistically they approach this issue?
Well, sure. So your example about dead naming is interesting in that it's a policy that is presumably motivated by a desire to protect people from seeing speech that they will find deeply discomforting and offensive. At the same time, it does reflect an underlying value judgment that is controversial in political circles, whether gender is a social construct and issues like that, which are genuinely complicated. So when you have a situation where the politics and the apolitical desire to prevent offense are conflated, it becomes very difficult to disentangle those. So it's not a question that it has any easy answer, and again gets to the fact that when any platform is making these value judgments, it's going to have some political repercussions. I mean, we think back to a lot of the debates over speech over the airwaves. It was conservatives who wanted the censorship to occur because they thought that messages were offensive to community values, even though those messages might involve things that many children perhaps would not want to see. So it's very difficult to disentangle the political aspects of a policy from the apolitical.
I want to put a little bit of a different approach, because I think there's a lot of these examples we can just sort of like knock down easily, and there's a lot of bad studies out there on claiming anti-conservative bias. But I think it's like, one, I want to say from a normative perspective, like following on what you're saying, I don't think there's like it's irrational to be worried about this, particularly in terms of like, you know, what the limits of like socially acceptable speech are, how these, you know, big platforms sort of like set their policies. It's something we should have a sort of interest in saying what ought to be acceptable and what isn't. Not requiring the government to step in is another issue. And then the other thing I want to say is that, you know, there are a lot of bad arguments for this out there, but I think what we should try to do as people who are maybe a little skeptical of this is to steel man their arguments for them, because I think they're going to get there eventually. And I think there are like steel man versions of some of these arguments that aren't easy to sort of like brush off, you know, just on the side, right? Like, I think you could, you know, similar to what some of the left's argument is around sort of AI being biased, you could make similar arguments around, well, Facebook and Google aren't deliberately trying to, you know, go after conservatives, but, you know, they inadvertently do so because of the way they set their algorithms and the like priors of the people in liberal Silicon Valley just sort of seep down. Or the mid and low level sort of moderation people who are making these decisions are given too much power and too little transparency. And since they're all a bunch of liberals sitting in Silicon Valley somewhere, you know, they can use their discretion, you know, like Facebook's trending topics and say, I'm going to, you know, crusade for social justice and downrank this thing that involves, you know, Tucker Carlson and not this other thing, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's hard to sort of debunk those kinds of arguments.
Yeah.
And they do raise like interesting issues that we shouldn't just sort of write off offhand. But I think where we do need to sort of tell our, you know, fellow right-leaning people is that like the solutions you're talking about aren't going to do the things you think they're going to do. And that's not really how you should be approaching it, even if you think there's like a real issue here.
Right. And it's possible for the cure to be worse than the harm and than what you're treating. This was true with the fairness doctrine. Good intentions, what it actually ended up doing was promoting the opposite of fairness. Same could be true with anti-viewpoint discrimination legislation, if ever it gets to that point, where it actually promotes viewpoint discrimination behind the scenes through regulatory capture or some other mechanism. So it's not to say there aren't trade-offs, because there are trade-offs that come with this, right? Like there are people who are just ordinary conservatives who might get swept up in an algorithmic sweep for alt-right, you know, white supremacists. That could happen. Have a you know, your Twitter account suspended temporarily. That's a loss. That's a downside. The question is, does the thing you do to try to fix that actually prevent that? And does it create greater harms that are even worse than that kind of?
Right. And this just goes to show that we need sort of better sort of policies and standards and governance around this within the platforms, not within the government. There is this, I think you went to that conference that Eric Goldman ran at Santa Clara, where they developed the Santa Clara principles. And there are a few of these sort of like frameworks out there that sort of suggest best practices for how moderation decisions should be made.
There's also recently a quite good Brennan and ACLU, CDT, and a couple others put together it's not First Amendment principles for moderation, but First Amendment principles for governing the internet, aimed at Congress, thinking about what the limits are as to their power to police or alter the private moderation of speech. Right. Outside of CDA 230, just writ large under the Constitution. And that, you know, even as much as they want to say control foreign misinformation or propaganda, Americans have a right to receive propaganda from foreign countries if they desire it. Who is it? Lamont, the Postmaster General?
This gets back to our episode that we did with John Samples, you and I, Will. In fact, this is, I think, a good place to leave this episode. This gets to big questions about governance structures. And so I think that's where we'll leave it today. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming on the show. Appreciate your time, Ryan and Zach. And for our listeners, until next week, be well. Thanks for listening. Building Tomorrow is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Building Tomorrow, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.